The term domestic violence doesn't fully express the experience of women who are terrorized by their intimate partners.
Another thing he did was at one point he went and got a rattlesnake and he brought it home and kept it in a cage and told her he would put it in bed with her or in the shower with her. And so I don't know what to call that. Is it living under a kind of terror? I think it is. And so I just think intimate terrorism is a more apt description of what it's like to live inside of it.
That's Rachel Louise Snyder. We talk with her about her groundbreaking book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. We also play an excerpt from my 2018 interview with historian Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz about her book about the Second Amendment, Loaded. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And check out our free podcast and weekly newsletter. You can sign up at writersvoice.net. You can also find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. After almost four decades of decline, murder among romantic partners is now on the rise. In 2017, there were over 2,000 such deaths. The vast majority of the victims are women, but their children as well. That's what happened to a friend and her children of my guest, Rachel Louise Snyder. Snyder was on tour promoting her acclaimed new book about intimate partner violence when she got the news that her friend had been murdered by her husband, who then turned the gun on himself. It was a terrible shock and irony for Snyder, whose book, No Visible Bruises, gives context to the epidemic of domestic violence. She frames her account of the scale of the epidemic around key stories that explode the common myths that if things were bad enough, victims would just leave, that shelter is an adequate response, and most insidiously, that violence inside the home is a private matter, sealed from the public sphere and disconnected from other forms of violence. Through the stories of victims, perpetrators, law enforcement, and reform movements from around the country, Snyder explores the real roots of private violence, its far-reaching consequences for society, and what it will take to truly address it. In addition to No Visible Bruises, Rachel Louise Snyder is the author of Fugitive Denim, a moving story of people and pants in the borderless world of global trade, and the novel What We've Lost Is Nothing. Her print work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Slate, and many other venues. Well, Rachel Louise Snyder, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is just such an important book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. First of all, the term domestic violence, you use that term, but you prefer another term, intimate partner terrorism. Tell us about that.
Well, the biggest problem is that domestic violence is such an abstraction as a term. It doesn't really capture what it feels like to be inside that kind of a relationship. And I'll give you an example. There's a woman in my book named Michelle, and her husband used to take the kids if she did something that upset him. He would take them and go camping for the night or go to a motel, and she would be just frantic with worry. So the kids were used as sort of coercion to keep her in line. And that's not unusual. You know, that it's really the anticipated terror of pain and physical injury or what could happen that really, I think, is so difficult to live with for people who are in this situation. Another thing he did was at one point he went and got a rattlesnake from outside their town. They lived in Billings, Montana, and he brought it home and kept it in a cage and told her he would put it in bed with her or in the shower with her. And so I don't know what to call that. It's not physical violence, but is it living under a kind of terror? I think it is. And so I just think intimate terrorism is a more apt description of what it's like to live inside of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the case you're talking about there is that of Michelle Monson Moser. Tell us more about what happened to her.
She met Rocky when she was 14 and he was 24. So this is not an unusual scenario to have a very young girl in this case, or a very young victim, or have a significant age gap between them. And, you know, she fell in love. She was pregnant by 15. She had two kids by the time she graduated from high school. And she was very determined to not be a statistic, to not be one of those, you know, young teenage girls who gets pregnant and then, you know, her life is ruined. Like, she really wanted to have a family, make it work. And he slowly began to wrest control and agency away from her. So, for example, he didn't want her to have friends over because he said it was a bad influence on the kids. And he didn't like hanging around with her family because he said that they didn't like him, which was true, right? He had gotten her pregnant at 15. I mean, he wasn't wrong about that, but it was this slow erosion of agency that you see that is so common, and it happened in their relationship as well.
And this was a very important case for you. How does this case of Michelle Monson Moser illuminate some of our misconceptions about victims of domestic violence? And maybe just start out by saying, what are some of the common misconceptions about victims of intimate terrorism or domestic violence?
You know, one of the questions that we always ask is, why didn't she just leave? Why didn't the victim just leave? And, you know, first of all, that puts the impetus for change on the victim rather than on the person who's actually perpetrating the crime. So it's a problematic question. But the other problem is that they do leave, and they leave all the time. It's just that we don't recognize what leaving looks like. So in the case of Michelle Moser, you know, once she realized that things were only going to get worse with Rocky, that, like, you know, his abuse was only going to get worse, she knew that she couldn't just up and leave with the kids, right? She couldn't move to a different state. When, you know, you have to enroll kids in school, and, you know, there's parental rights involved. And so she knew she couldn't just up and leave with them. So instead, she did things like, she had the house was owned by her father, and they rented it from him. So she had her father put the house in her name secretly so that she could eventually get Rocky kicked out. And he wouldn't let her work outside the home, but she was taking classes at Montana State University to become a nurse, with an eye toward being able to support her kids at some point, because she knew that she'd have to have a job, right? And so she was putting all these things in place, but it's a long-term process. It's not an event. And what we discovered, or what was discovered in the aftermath of Michelle, Rocky eventually shot their kids and shot himself in November of 2001. And what we discovered, I think, or what the state discovered, was that there were so many small changes that could have been made in her situation that would have helped. I mean, we can't say for sure, like, yes, it would have kept her alive. But for example, the police only were called one time on Rocky, and that was by Michelle's mother. And they came to the house, and Rocky had broken in, taken his older daughter, and then taken her camping for the night, taken her to a motel, sorry. And Michelle, of course, was frantic with worry. And for the first time ever, she began to tell her mother of these years of abuse that she suffered at Rocky's hands. And so her mother's the one who called the police, and the police came and they said, well, what do you want us to charge him with? It's his own daughter. You know, he wasn't charged with breaking and entering. He had hit Michelle's sister and left pretty significant bruising and cuts on her to try to get at his daughter, you know, endangering the life of a minor. There's all kinds of things he could have been charged with. Instead, they were going to charge him with criminal mischief. And Michelle went and filed a restraining order. When Rocky came back, he got arrested, but his parents bailed him out almost immediately. He called them and he manipulated them and convinced them that, you know, he knew he was wrong and he wouldn't do it again, and he had a right to his kids, and they believed him. And so they bailed him out. And as soon as Michelle found out that he had been bailed out, she was back at the DA's office recanting everything. She said she'd made it up about the snake. She said it was them against the state. She didn't want to press charges. And all of this, we know now, the recanting and all of that, has to do with the idea that she's trying to negotiate with someone that she knows is dangerous and who is now dangerous and enraged, which was Rocky. The state of Montana, if you are arrested for domestic violence today, you will not be able to bail out first thing in the morning like Rocky did. You cannot see a judge until the afternoon. And it's such a small thing, but what it does is give domestic violence advocates a little bit of time to get to a victim, to create a safety plan, to maybe change locks, to get an abuser possibly on GPS, to put all kinds of things in place, right? So that what happened with Michelle and Rocky doesn't happen again, hopefully.
Yeah, in fact, you say in the book that as tragic as it was, her death actually saved a lot of lives. What do you mean by that?
So there were all kinds of small suggestions that came out of her death that what's called the fatality review team in the state of Montana recommended. And these fatality review teams exist all over the country. Most states have them, I think all, but just a very few handful. And they exist for this very purpose. They exist to look at domestic violence homicides and figure out gaps in the system at the statewide level. So in the state of Montana, where Michelle was killed, one of the changes they made was to not let abusers bail out first thing in the morning. Another one is they created something called the Hope Card. So an active restraining order most often is printed on paper and victims get one and they have to carry that one around with them. And what they found was that, you know, paper disintegrates or a victim forgets the restraining order at home or because it's on paper becomes illegible for whatever reason. And there was a woman actually killed as a result of a police officer not being able to read that her restraining order was active. This was around the same time as Michelle's death. And so they created what's called the Hope Card, which is a credit card sized restraining order that is laminated, that has a picture of the abuser, the active dates of the restraining order, any exclusion zones that the abuser is not allowed to enter. And victims can get 20 of these cards if they want to. They can pass them around at their kids' school. They can pass them around at their place of work. They can pass them around to their clergy at church, right? Anywhere that they're supposed to go. So again, in the case of Michelle and Rocky, a neighbor saw him peering in the windows of his house at some point before he killed the whole family. That's the kind of thing where had that neighbor had a copy of the restraining order, the Hope Card, she would have seen, oh, he's not supposed to be there right now. I'm going to call the police. But she didn't know that. So it's really, I mean, a lot of the changes are really small and they seem insignificant, but they end up having a really huge ripple effect on individual cases.
Yeah. And let's take just a little step back for a moment and talk about the scope of this kind of intimate terrorism that you speak about in this book, Rachel Snyder. No visible bruises. What is the scope? Who is most likely to be a victim, if that's even known? And is it getting worse?
Well, you know, it depends on your marker, actually. I mean, there's a couple different ways I could answer that. You know, one thing that emerged only after the book was published, they came out in the middle of May. There's a Northeastern University professor out of Boston who keeps stats on domestic violence homicides in this country. And according to his statistics, since 2017, domestic violence homicides are on the rise by more than 30% in this country, by something like 33%. Now, you can look at that and say, my God, it's definitely getting worse. I mean, just the sheer numbers. But you can also look at that and say 2017 was when the Me Too movement really began to gain momentum. And I think that there is an aspect of retaliatory violence to that. And so another way of looking at those chilling numbers is to say women are particularly the victims. Women are no longer being silent about this. Women are no longer going to stand by while, you know, a Jeffrey Epstein takes victim after victim after victim, right? We're not going to stand for it anymore. And so I think on the one hand, the numbers are grim. On the other hand, I think that women's rage and women's movements are being galvanized in a way that we just haven't seen in a long time. I think the other part of that question, who is a victim, is a lot more difficult to answer. You know, I don't think I interviewed a single person who was a victim of domestic violence who didn't say some version of like, I'm not your typical victim to me. No one thinks of themselves as a typical victim, whatever that means. And I think in part because domestic violence doesn't happen sort of overnight in a vacuum, right? It happens with, in the, like it did with Rocky and Michelle, with this kind of slow erosion of agency. You know, one of the things that I talk about in the book with Rocky and Michelle is he had done videotape recordings of their family throughout the years. And her father gave me a copy. It was about 14 hours of recordings. And in the early years, when the kids were really little, you'd see them, you know, as babies on the tapes or whatever. Rocky would wake up Michelle by throwing the covers off her, and then he would pan like up her legs and to her rear. And she was really beautiful. She had a beautiful figure. And in the beginning, you could see her say, stop it, that kind of joking around, that we're still in love voice, you know, like this lover's teasing. And then as you see the kids start to get older and Rocky continues to do that, she hated to be videotaped. You can see her getting angrier and she says like, stop it, cut it out. She's getting a little more, you know, vehement with him filming her essentially in the nude or in underwear. And he never stops, right? And he laughs at her, he insults her. And then in the a tape that was one of the very last tapes they took just a couple of months before they died, they're hiking together as a family and he does it again. And the kids are older now and he pans up her legs and he makes some joke on the tape about like, hey kids, look at your mom's power there. Look at that, you know, rear or whatever he says. And she doesn't say a thing. And I think there in a nutshell is a loss of agency. There's no physical violence that happens that is apparent in those tapes. And yet what you see is a loss of agency. He's disrespecting her. He doesn't listen to her. And she just gives up trying at some point. And so it's not so much that there's a typical victim as that there's a typical narrative that these relationships all follow, no matter who you are, no matter if you're rich or poor, black, white, from this culture or a different culture, that the narrative is almost always the same.
One of the researchers of this, someone I actually know from way back, is Evan Stark, who talked about coercive control. Evan Stark was very involved in the anti-domestic violent movement in New Haven.
Yeah, there's a question about whether he coined the term coercive control, but he certainly defined it. He's got a book written about it. And coercive control, which is exactly what we're talking about when we talk about taking the kids for a night or threatening somebody with a rattlesnake, right? Coercive control is one of the most insidious forms of domestic violence. And in fact, there are laws against coercive control in the UK, in France, and now most recently in Ireland. And I know that New York and California, there's some lawmakers who are looking into the possibility of putting forth a bill about coercive control. But so far in this country, we don't really have any movement. And it's that coercive control that is, I think, the most insidious when we're talking about domestic violence.
Going back to the victims not being typical at all, you yourself were on book tour when you got the news that a friend of yours had been murdered.
Yeah. Well, and it's even a little more complicated than that. It's one of my closest friend's brothers murdered his wife and then himself. And I knew the couple, the woman killed, her name was Lola, and Jason, the brother of my friend, because my daughter went to school with their older daughter and is good friends with their very good close friends. So it shook the whole community, but it also shook me sort of personally. I got off a plane in the middle of this book tour and thought, I can't, like, this is a savage irony. And it's been, you know, it's only been a month since that happened. So in some ways, my circle of friends are still sort of wrapping our heads around it. Like, we knew them both, you know, we know their kids. They both worked for, you know, they were foreign service diplomats. And, they both knew about my book. I mean, they both were invited to the book release party in DC where we all live. Yeah. I don't even know what to say about it. Just that it's, you know, his sister has like been incredible. And she's like, this is what you do. You have to keep talking about it. It's hard though.
I can imagine. And so talk about, you know, some of the other aspects of, you know, the kind of characterological factors that create this kind of terrorism, mostly among men. I mean, not exclusively, but the vast majority is practiced by men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I mean, there are certain aspects that are typical. You know, we think, when we think of abusers, we think like rageaholic, or we think, oh, I'd be able to recognize it. I'm, you know, I'm educated. I'm whatever, you know, I'm self-aware. And yet only about 25% of abusers fit that rageaholic definition. The other 75% know perfectly well how to act in society. They're not raging at their boss or their coworkers. They're not, you know, necessarily out there with road rage. So it's an issue of, for them anyway, it's an issue of power and control. They tend to be profoundly, deeply narcissistic. I don't mean like, you know, your garden variety sent, you know, I'm great, the center of the universe. I mean, almost like a clinical diagnosis of narcissism disorder. They tend to be very black and white thinkers. You know, it's my way or the highway. They tend to feel kind of eternally underappreciated for, you know, like they always feel sort of shortchanged in their relationship. She doesn't appreciate what I do, blah, blah, blah. That kind of narrative runs through this. But even the abusers, you know, I sat in on batterers intervention groups really around the country. And so many of them were like made up of guys that were normal, right? That I would have like gone out for a beer with. Like, there was nothing about them that was like telltale to me in any way. And it was really unsettling because it made me realize like any of us could find ourselves in this kind of situation. And you invest years of your life in a relationship and then suddenly someone's insulting you. You're not going to walk away at the first sign of distress, you know? These are complicated relationships.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with journalist Rachel Louise Snyder about intimate partner violence in the U.S. Her book is No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Yes, I know. In fact, I was a victim of domestic violence. I did leave after the second time I got hit because, you know, my mother, in fact, said, you've got to leave him because he'll do it again. But when I told other people about it, they said, really? He just seems so nice.
Yeah, yeah. I know, right? I mean, that's the thing is like they, and I'm so happy that you got out and that you were able to listen to your mother. But, you know, I mean, so often it's like, this is happening in a much larger context. It might be someone that you share children with, right? It might be certainly someone that you have many, many happy memories and maybe even just some mediocre memories, right? But like, relationships aren't made up of one violent act after another or one coercive act after another, right? You've got Christmases together or Hanukkahs or other holidays. You've got trips together. You've got, you know, you've got all this other context of him being nice or him being remorseful or him being, you know, conciliatory or whatever. So it does take quite a lot to extract oneself from a relationship like this. And I also think it's important to point out that there's, you know, there's abuse and then there's really dangerous, high risk domestic violence situations that can become homicide. And I think it's important to kind of like think about those differently, right? Not everybody who leaves is going to be in danger of being killed. They just need to kind of bide their time because, you know, this violence tends to exist on a scale. So the first 90 days, says the research, you know, risk is a little higher. And then after 90 days, it begins to drop off a little bit, but it stays relatively high for the first year. So sometimes it's a matter of building protections around a victim for enough time that it takes, you know, it takes her, the ending of her relationship, to kind of play its course out emotionally.
So you're saying the most dangerous time is within 90 days after leaving the abuser.
After leaving, yeah.
So these, the abuser programs, it was very interesting, the part of the book, the second part of the book that really goes into, you know, focuses on the men and treatment of them. You know, a lot of people are sent to anger management, which never seemed to me to work very well. You talk about a program that sounds very effective, the RSVP program. Tell us about the RSVP program and Jimmy Espinoza.
Yes. So, you know, the efficacy of any offenders intervention program is, you know, some are certified, some are not, some have very weak certifications. I've been asked, you know, while I've been on my book tour, like, who did you write this book for? And I, you know, my answer is like, everyone. I think everyone should read it, of course. But I also think that judges in particular need to read it for exactly what you're talking about, because so often anger management is conflated with batterer's intervention. And that is where we get that deep misunderstanding of like, well, we would recognize a rageaholic, right? But you're not working with a rageaholic when you're working with a batterer most of the time. So I think it's important to kind of talk about those things separately. The RSVP program is different than other offender intervention programs. It uses a curriculum called Man Alive, and it's in a particular jail in San Francisco County called the San Bruno Jail that has a dedicated domestic violence wing. So everyone who's in there has domestic violence in their background in some sense as abusers. It may not be the main primary reason they're in prison, but they get into this wing because of this, because of their domestic violence history. And so it's 5 days a week, the RSVP program, about 6 hours a day. It used to be longer, and it lasts for about a year. And it's really an incredible program. Researchers looked at the way that they ran this program, and they found an 85% drop in recidivism rates with guys who completed the program, not started it. They had to complete the whole year. But that's a pretty impressive number. The problem, of course, is that it costs money. And in this country, we don't think of prison as a place to rehabilitate people. We think of prison as a place to lock people up and forget about them. And so we're perpetrating this cycle of violence over and over and over again. And unfortunately, RSVP, which has been running for like 20 years, has been replicated almost nowhere because it's expensive to run.
And effective, though.
And effective. I mean, it's not perfect, right? You're still dealing with human beings, and you're still dealing with very violent men. So they did have an RSVP guy who was taking their classes get out of prison. He didn't finish the program, but he got out before he finished, and he ended up, you know, killing his partner, and it was incredibly devastating for everyone involved. So, you know, I think we have to remember that we are always dealing with some element of unpredictability. But for a lot of these guys, you know, and restorative justice is a big part of their curriculum. For a lot of these guys, it's the first time they've ever like had a sense of how their violence affects someone else's life. It's the first time they've, for example, deconstructed a moment of violence to figure out what they look like to someone else externally, right? Like their voice raises, their fists clench, their muscles tense up, right? Like a lot of men in this situation are very intimidating. And it's also really stunning to them to learn that they are the products of a culture that has a certain set of expectations about their behavior as well. Like so many of these guys, like, again, it's, you know, they're narcissistic. So they think they are who they are because of, you know, how they want to be. And in fact, they learn through gender education that culture expects a certain behavior out of them as much as it does women. And that's really shocking and sort of mind blowing to a lot of them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a culture of toxic masculinity, and your description of it is really wonderful, Rachel Louise Snyder in No Visible Bruises. Just the description of how they deconstruct that idea of male privilege and bring out the sense of what it means to be intimate as opposed to coercive of somebody.
I know, exactly. You can't just sort of demystify behavior. You have to offer a different set of skills, right? And so one of the things that I think offender intervention programs do that are more successful are offer not just intimacy skills, but I've seen them offer parenting classes, for example, or further gender education, right? I mean, it's a matter of sort of educating from all angles. And so the most successful ones are the ones that really try to attempt to replace those behaviors with other types of behavior, right? Like, this is one way to be in the world, but here's another way to be in the world.
You know, earlier you said that the Me Too movement may be leading to a kind of violent backlash on the part of men. I don't think we can be surprised about that. That has also happened, as, I mean, in civil rights for people of color, for example, for black people, there have been backlashes. What are you talk in the book No Visible Bruises that you still have reasons for hope. What are your reasons for hope? What do you see going forward? And do you see women being able to ultimately really change the culture?
Well, I think men need to be allied with us in this. I think it cannot just be women. And I think one of the things, during the Kavanaugh hearings, there was just this sense, I watched those from morning till night. I mean, it was like 12 hours straight of that congressional hearing, and I was just glued to C-SPAN. And all over the country, there were conversations happening between women and their husbands or their brothers or their male friends or their fathers or their uncles, where it was like, yeah, this happened to me when I was 15. This happened to me when I was 14. And I feel like for many of us, and I include myself in that, I had a conversation with my father. That was really an eye-opening moment for men, not only to find out like how widespread sexual assault is, but that women, I think, also didn't realize that a lot of men just didn't know, right? Like, didn't have a sense of the scale. And my biggest hope is that the Me Too movement will provide something like that for domestic violence, where we will not be afraid to tell our stories. We will tell them with boldness, with brashness, and with a sense of justice in the world, that these need to change, that these conversations need to not be conversations mired in shame. So that's one thing. The other thing is that, like, I do think that women's anger in particular is galvanizing. I think that's why you're seeing record numbers of elected officials, and we need to have more. Certainly, there's more glass ceilings that need to be broken. But the women's anger gives me hope, because women's anger brings about change in this society. I mean, look at suffrage, right? Like, it was women's anger that got us the suffrage movement, which we're, now celebrating the 100th year of our right to vote. And that societies move slowly, but societies tend to move first before policy moves. And I think we are in a moment of great movement. I think women look at the current president that we have. They look at situations like Harvey Weinstein. They look at situations like, Jeffrey Epstein, and they say, that's it. That's enough. This is never going to be okay again.
And your book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Rachel Snyder, it has been such an important part of creating that conversation nationally. And thank you so much for bringing that conversation to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fabulous.
In addition to No Visible Bruises, Rachel Louise Snyder is the author of Fugitive Denim, a moving story of people and pants in the borderless world of global trade, and the novel What We've Lost Is Nothing. Next up, we talk about the roots of the Second Amendment and its link to white supremacy. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice free podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. As we produce this week's show, the nation is once again wrestling with grief and outrage over the latest spate of mass shootings, this time in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. Once again, the Second Amendment and what it means is being debated. Is the right for any individual to buy assault weapons really what our founding fathers were thinking of when they passed the Second Amendment? And is there a connection between the gun rights movement and white supremacy, not just today, but one that has deep roots in American history? Historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, has some surprising answers to those questions. I spoke with her in 2018, soon after the Parkland mass shooting in Florida. She says that in order to understand the current obstacles to gun control, we have to understand the history of U.S. gun policy, from its role in the settling of America and the early formation of the new nation up to the present. I thought this was, sadly, a good time to play an extended excerpt from that interview. This book, Loaded, A Disarming Look at the Second Amendment, it certainly has come out in an opportune time.
Well, unfortunately, almost any time it would have come out would have been, you know, very close to one of these mass shootings, not a school shooting, but the one last fall in Las Vegas when I was finishing up the book. And it's just too frequent, you know, so it... But it is, it's been useful in being able to explain some things when people are paying attention.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you point out that we have more than 300 million guns in the U.S., one for every inhabitant. Total gun deaths in the U.S. average around 37,000 a year, which is incredible. And as you point out, mass shootings in the U.S. average more than one per day. Your book, Loaded, tells a story of how we got here, and I think it's very much a story that's unknown by most Americans. You say neither gun rights advocates nor gun control advocates have any idea what the Second Amendment was originally about. So, what was it about?
I should have added there that U.S. historians also fail to acknowledge what it was really about. Although they give confusing explanations and don't even agree with each other. But it has to be seen in the context of what was happening at the time and how normalized violence was since the very first colony was established in 1607 in Jamestown. And the violence was directed at the indigenous people who were farmers. They were fisher people along the coast, but in ancient societies, living in villages all up and down the coast and in that area colonized. So it was settlers coming, settler colonialism, and they come, you know, they immediately attack the native people and try to take their land. And it's already cultivated land, so they're really appropriating finished land, land that can be worked immediately. So it's not like, you know, they're fighting the sort of image of sort of fighting these hunter-gatherers in the forest who have no concept of land. They're very settled people, in fact, across the continent. That's the case. So it's very traumatic, you know, from day one of the colonization, and that goes on for 150 years before the Declaration of Independence. So in that process, they very quickly, in Massachusetts, 1620, the Pilgrims come. 12 years later, they have formed volunteer citizens, patrols, militias, to carry out these brutal killing of civilians, unarmed civilians, because none of these native people were in wars, you know, they were not, they were farmers, you know, so it took a while for them to be able to resist. And when they did, you know, they tried to get that land back. So with wars, you know, taking place, but the violence was brutal. It was, you know, basically counterinsurgency, attacking civilians, attacking their food supply, burning their crops, burning their storage of food, and driving them out in that way, and killing many of them in the process. You know, the English had already been doing that in Ireland for a century, so this kind of killing civilians and taking their land was already institutionalized, so it was almost a knee-jerk reaction, you know, to behave that way once they came. There had been English traders and Spanish and French off the coast with native people. Their ships would be out and the native people would take items out to trade with the Europeans. So there had been about, you know, 40 years of peaceful trading and interchange. But when, well, it was first 1607 in Jamestown that settlers came that had the intention of, they were contracted. These were all stockholding corporations that recruited these settlers. And the ones they brought to Virginia were very brutal. They wanted to raise tobacco. They knew the tobacco had become an expensive product in Europe, and it was, you know, it originated in North America, the tobacco. Not like we know it today, but, you know, it got more and more refined. But they wanted to make it into a commercial crop to export and to get into that market that the Spanish and Portuguese had already exploited as well. So they decided to take the land and become planters, and then that became the way that 13 colonies were settled. So these militias, you know, developed in each of those colonizing, and they didn't just then take the land and stay there. They tried to expand all the time because they would wear the land out. It was very rich land, but with a monocrop commercial production and not leaving the land fallow as the native people had, and letting it refurbish its nutrients and everything for food crops, and also planting those in relation to each other, the food crops, so that they nourish each other, it just wears the land out. So then they would want to abandon that land and take more land, richer land, either that or expand their plantations. So it was constant warfare for 150 years, not a minute without warring on the native people all up and down the colonies. And then in the 1670s, they had brought black and white people as indentured servants on contracts, but they gradually were developing a racial code of slavery. So by the 1670s, this racial code of all black people could be enslaved was in place. And then they started using these militias also for slave patrols and controlling slave patrols. And that's really the genealogy of present-day police forces, the practices of the slave patrol. So that's why you have so many killing of especially young black men.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz about her new book, Loaded. So you're really saying that the roots of the Second Amendment lie very much in the dual atrocities by which this country was founded: settler colonialism, the expropriation and slaughter of Native Americans, and slavery. So now bring us to the Second Amendment. There was a Declaration of Independence, and then there was the Constitution, and then the Second Amendment. I've heard that the Second Amendment was about making sure that white citizens were armed and organized into militias to furnish slave patrols and fight Indians.
Yeah, and the Second Amendment was when the colonies declared independence. They declared independence, each 13 colonies, as 13 independent nation states. And the Constitution was, you know, 7 years later, which brought together a federal system that would supposedly loosely connect all of these. So the Constitution was really about the powers of the federal government, the powers of the state, the division of powers in the federal government, interstate commerce, you know, all of these things about structure, but it wasn't about people, it wasn't about people's rights. So the Ten Amendments were added as individual rights. And these already existed in a separate state. Each of those states made their own constitutions in 1776. And most of them, not all of them, but notably Virginia, had provisions for militias and the right to bear arms based on the continuation of these practices already going on. So they, without any debate, no documented debate or discussion or anything else, it was simply transported in the language we know it as now into the federal Ten Amendments, the rights of man, you know, individual rights. So a lot of people want to argue that these referred to, because they has the term well-regulated, but these citizens' militias who organized themselves, and they were not paid by anyone from the outside, they self-organized in their own interests. They were quite regulated within themselves, you know. So it says that in order not to refer just to some, you know, gang of bandits or something that would have this right. And they, you know, a lot of people think that means it's like what the National Guard is today. And so it's, you know, it's obsolete. But what became the National Guard, the so-called state militias that already existed in the colonies, that were, you know, governmental, this was already provided for in the Constitution. The army was found in the Constitution, and the state militias, which became the National Guard later on. So there was no need to have that in the amendment if it was a collective government measure. You know, it would make no sense at all. So people who argue that, you know, a lot of politicians, but even some constitutional scholars and historians make that argument. And sometimes I wonder, have they read the Constitution? You know, these things are already provided for.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking about the history of the Second Amendment with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Her book is Loaded. So let me get this clear. You're saying the Second Amendment really does guarantee the individual right to bear arms?
Right, and to organize themselves in groups to basically aggressive control.
See, that's a link I think a lot of people miss, that it's not just about the right to bear individual arms. It's about the individual's right to create these citizens' militias that will enforce social control on Native Americans and Black people.
Yes, and the example that you can go through is, you know, the slave patrols. When the Civil War came, they continued, you know, throughout the Civil War. I mean, they didn't have as much control because, you know, a lot of enslaved Africans were able to escape and go to the Northern troops, you know, join the Union Army. So it was kind of chaotic, but they tried, you know, to continue the slave patrols. But then after the end of the Civil War, 6 months afterwards, voluntary militias had organized all over the South, illegal, under United States Army occupation. It was illegal, and that was the Ku Klux Klan. And then when Reconstruction, when the Army pulled out prematurely, it made Reconstruction collapse because these people were already organized, and these Klansmen simply took off their hoods and their garb and became the police and the sheriffs. So there's, you know, there's this kind of clueless history of the Klan. Well, suddenly they didn't exist anymore, as if, but what existed was a clamped down Jim Crow, you know, and These were the police and the sheriffs. Because the United States Army and the North had hands off. They decided on reconciliation and let things go back like they were without legal slavery, but there was still convict labor, prison labor, indebtedness, all, you know, just a kind of slavery without the institution, but under their own laws, legal. So that's how you can trace a lot of these white nationalist groups. You saw the Klan arising again in during World War One, as basically to attack foreign-born people, immigrants, and more immigrants who were not just Germanic or English, were coming from Southern Europe, Italy, and Greece. And so they were organized against these foreign-born. And many of the socialists, industrial workers, that's why they came to work in industry in the North, were also socialists and have been socialists in their own country. So there was a big socialist movement, a big labor movement. So the Klan reorganized for that purpose. Jim Crow was still in effect. But it wasn't, you know, when you got to 1950, or really 1940, you had a complete white republic. Everything locked down. Jim Crow in the South, total control of black people. A diaspora from the South happened to northern cities to work and to escape Jim Crow. But they were still ghettoized, and the police became pretty much like they were in the South, controlling the black population, segregated housing, job discrimination, where they could only do the, you know, not the well-paid work or the union jobs or whatever. And then with the war industry for Second World War, much more of a diaspora even to Los Angeles and to Oakland. So you also had the ghettoization there and the police forces becoming very much like slave patrols in those two cities, which has followed us to today. So everything was locked down, though, in 1940. Native Americans were all confined to reservations, or they were scattered, you know, into for jobs into different cities around the country. They had not much connection among each other, although there was a beginning of a kind of civil rights movement among Native Americans during that period when the Black civil rights movement was just beginning. And there had been, you know, an intellectual class of African Americans, W.B. Du Bois and a few lawyers. And he had formed the NAACP in 1901. So, you know, it was a long history of struggle, but they were in the North, you know. They really couldn't crack the South. But they were studying the situation. What kind of legislation or laws could they get through or get to the Supreme Court to break this down? So they had this great victory in 1954 with the Supreme Court desegregation decision, Brown versus Board of Education. And this was a really traumatic event for the white republic. It was really like a bolt of lightning. And very quickly, a lot of very wealthy white men formed the John Birch Society. And among the charter members was Fred Koch of the Koch Industries in Wichita, Kansas, still with us, you know, on the right wing. And Welch himself, who was the main founder, was the heir of the Welch Candy Company. And a lot of men, white men from the oil and gas industry, the war, the defense industry, which was still, became huge in World War II and continued to be huge with the competition with the Soviet Union, the arms race. And these were very wealthy men. They spawned a militia. They called themselves the Minutemen, who were actually crushed by the FBI at the time. But the John Birch Society continued on, and they created a a way of organizing. And for wealthy people, it wasn't just money. They actually won a lot of hearts and minds of ordinary white working class people and just white people, white collar white people. And it started in Orange County, but it spread across the country of what they call the kitchen table organizing, kitchen table democracy. So they would have, you know, engage women in this, for women to sit and write letters to their congressmen, letters to their local, and take over school boards. And, you know, by 1970, they controlled a lot of school boards throughout the country. Of course, in the South, they had never, you know, controlled them all anyway, but in the North, and started in California. So that right-wing movement, you know, you saw it kind of pop up with the Barry Goldwater campaign. And in California, Ronald Reagan very much, you know, was friendly with the John Birchers. I don't know if he was a member, formal member or not, but he was an anti-labor person. And he came to Powers, the governor of California, for 8 years. So this was a great right-wing victory, getting Ronald Reagan into office.
Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz talking with us in 2018 about her book, Loaded. She's also the author of, among others, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, Roots of Resistance, and Blood on the Border. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.